Chapter 3. Boba, how has your illness progressed? Has my data been of use to you? My offer still stands. Town Wee, former human clone development supervisor on Kamino, now head of clone adjustment at Arcanian Micro. Galactic City Spaceport, Coruscant. It was a planet of a trillion people, and Ben knew Coruscant well enough now to vanish within it. He shut himself down in the Force long before the flight from Bespin landed in Galactic City, more out of fear of implicating the people he intended to contact than worrying that Jason would sense him and come after him. Knowing Jason, he'd probably written Ben off as a weakling who couldn't take it. Ben was consigned to the also-rans, minor disappointments Jason would deal with when he came across them. And Ben had his sources. They said Tahiri had pretty well taken his place at Jason's side. At Galactic City Spaceport, the transport disgorged its long-haul passengers, and Ben slipped through in the merging streams of bodies from all parts of the galaxy, a single fish in a multicolored shoal. With the easy obscurity of sun visor and a cap, he was just another young man out of millions in the Galactic City area. And maybe it was wishful thinking, but he thought he detected a faint growth of beard, more fluff than anything, but it was still different. He didn't look like Lieutenant Skywalker. Ben logged his identichip at the transit security control gate, bogus, naturally, one of a dozen he carried, and was still expecting a sudden wail of alarms for a good 10 paces as he headed for the open walkway. But nothing happened. All he had to do now was remember to disguise his walk to defeat the gate recognition system on security cams, and then he could wander around at will. A small pebble in each boot changed his stride enough to cheat the software without crippling him. In his bag, a reversible bag, there were various changes of clothing. He got as far as the first public refreshers by a branch of the Bank of Argal and started adding to the deception. "That's your problem, Jason. You taught me all this. Or at least the GAG did." In a cubicle, he changed his tunic, cap, and pants, turned the bag inside out to show its light brown side, and repacked. He changed shoes to ones with stack heels. Then he emerged a totally different person, walking differently and dressed differently. He'd keep doing that, and the security cams would have no pattern to track. Lan Shevu's girlfriend, Shula Palasch, worked for a haulage company. He'd start with her. No comlink calls, just in case. The GAG might be monitoring, the same way Ben had eavesdropped on senators and politicians when he was in the guard. He made his way to Shula's workplace, doubling back occasionally, just as Jory LeCouf had... It hit him hard sometimes. Even when he was mired in grief over Mom, LeCouf would suddenly appear in his mind, and he'd feel it all over again. It wasn't any less of a sense of loss than the one he felt for his mother, just different, and it could still make him stop breathing for a moment while he steadied himself. LeCouf had taught him about evading detection and tracking others, so this was another way of ensuring that his sacrifice to save Ben hadn't been in vain. Using that training to bring down Jason was right. Ben swung right into a walkway lined with clothing stores and tap calves. What do I really mean by bring him down? He was sure now that he didn't mean killing him. It wasn't Ben's job to be the judge. He was just getting a case together, and someone else would decide what to do with Jason in the end. What do you do with a deposed dictator? A Sith, too. And if Dad sorts him out and gets him back to the light side, how can I even be in the same room as him after what he's done? First things first. And first was proving a case against him. Although Ben knew there were ordinary folk who'd say that Jason was already guilty of enough, and that killing a Jedi didn't actually take him into a new category of monstrosity. It was just a personal act of betrayal, and Ben knew he had to put that aside. Most murders happen within families. Did I think we'd be any different? Yes, I did. We're Jedi. Ben alternated between speeder bus, paying by cash credits, not traceable chips, and walking between docking stations. He was finding he didn't need to affect a different walk now. The slightly higher heels had altered the angle of his spine, giving him twinges. An hour and a few changes of appearance later, he stood outside a branch depot of Galactusend. When he walked in, he couldn't see a face he recognized. It was a busy place. Beings of all kinds lined up waiting to dispatch parcels or held data pads in their hands, checking in consignments. He intercepted a droid in Galactusend livery, skimming through the reception area. "Is Shula around?" he asked. "Shula Palasch?"
"She no longer works here," said the droid.
Well, that was sudden. It could only have happened recently, because the last time he'd spoken to Shevu, she'd still been here.
"Thanks," he said,
and wandered out to amble along the walkway and rethink his strategy. He'd have to go direct to Shevu's apartment now. He hadn't wanted to, just in case Shevu was under surveillance, but he still had the pass card, and if Shevu had changed the code, well, that wouldn't slow Ben down much. He spent the next couple of hours taking a circuitous route to the apartment block. By the time he got to the last leg of the journey, he was tired and fed up with changing his clothing. As in most apartment buildings in the capital, an array of crime prevention cams kept watch on the entrance. Ben visualized the sensors getting a sudden burst of intense light, using the force to overload them for a moment to give him time to pass into the turbo lift. All the monitoring system would see was a short period of dark shapes as the cam tried to compensate for the light levels its sensor told it were there. At the 400th floor, Ben slipped out into the corridor and stood outside Chevu's door for a moment, trying to sense if anyone was inside. It felt empty. Ben tried the pass card, and it didn't work. It took him a couple of seconds to force-wipe the lock to its default setting and slip inside. He'd stayed here before, when Shevu had given him a bolt hole, so he wouldn't have to go home and face Luke. There was a sense of familiarity about it that was at odds with the feeling that he was violating his friend's privacy. But Shevu would understand. The clutter of personal possessions had gone. Shula's collection of stuffed toy animals in unlikely colors, piles of holovids, the heptalian-embroidered throw that used to adorn a chair. And Ben wondered if the pair had just sold up and left, and he was now in a stranger's home, waiting for the new owner to walk in to find a Jedi burglar sitting on the sofa. A quick check of the closets and kitchen cupboards showed that Shevu still lived there. Those were his uniforms, his bolo ball gear, the boxes of pepper-flavored breadsticks he seemed to live on. But every trace of Shula was gone. Even the holopics of the couple enjoying a vacation on Naboo. Maybe they'd broken up. That would have been a surprise, but a job like the GAG put a strain on relationships. And under Jason, the GAG was getting harder for former CSF cops like Shevu to handle. Ben settled down facing the door and resisted the temptation to calm his old captain to check which shift pattern he was on. That didn't seem to count for much with the GAG lately, though. It was a round-the-chrono job. Ben occupied his time by reading his data pad and speculating. 4 hours later, force senses on edge, he felt a familiar presence and rehearsed all the different ways he could start telling Shevu that Jason was now out of control. "Do I mention Mom first, or do I work up to that?" he decided to play it by ear. Footsteps paused outside the doors. The silence went on longer than Ben would have expected for Chevu to find his pass card, and then the doors parted, and Ben realized what a bad idea it was to surprise a trained cop. The whir of a charging blaster made him leap up just as Chevu burst through the gap and fired. Ben deflected the bolt, sending a stack of holozine pads smoking to the floor.
"Sir, sir, it's me! It's Ben!" He held out both arms well away from his body. "Hold fire!"
Chevu, panting and wide-eyed, was down on one knee by the cover of an armchair, with his service blaster still leveled at Ben.
"Stang, Ben!" he snapped.
His shoulders relaxed instantly, and he shut his eyes for a moment.
"Don't do that! Call ahead, for goodness sake!"
"Sorry. Sorry about the damage, too."
Chevu stepped back into the corridor and said something to a person Ben couldn't see. The neighbors had stuck their heads out of their doorways to see what the noise was about, and Ben heard a few words like, "Thought I had a burglar, but it's a buddy," before Chevu shut the doors behind him and stood looking down at Ben.
"It's lucky you're a Jedi."
Chevu seemed much more shaken than he would have been on a genuinely dangerous mission.
"Or you'd have been a dead buddy."
"I tried to find Shula first. I didn't want to compromise you by calming you direct."
Chevu picked up the scattered and melted holozines. Some had fused into a single lump.
"You're in trouble."
"No. Jason is."
"Oh, that's okay then."
Chevu flashed his eyebrows.
"We're all in the poodoo. We've been told you're not GAG personnel any longer. Jason didn't say why you'd left, but when he suggested that we tell him if we ever saw you, I reached my own conclusions. It's kind of hard to ignore the mayhem going on with the Jedi Council."
Chevu checked himself as if he'd just made a terrible gaffe.
"What kind of buddy am I?
I'm sorry about your mother, Ben. I really am. That was thoughtless of me." Ben took a breath and dived straight in. The cue was there.
"It was Jason who killed her."
"Yeah, you're right."
It wasn't the casual way Chevu said it that shocked Ben, as much as the fact he said it at all. Chevu wasn't appalled. He wasn't even mildly surprised.
"You knew?"
"Come on, Ben. You know rules of evidence as well as I do." "I've got nothing solid."
Chevu checked the window locks and rechecked the door, as if he was used to watching his back these days. Then he went into the kitchen, and the noise of clacking plates, running water, and snapping cupboard catches drifted into the living room with the sudden scent of fresh calf.
"It's got his fingerprints all over it, though. Not that Jedi leave any, of course. He'd be the first suspect whose collar I'd feel, believe me."
"My folks and the other Jedi think it was Ali Marar."
"Who's she?"
"A crazy dark Jedi with a grudge against Aunt Leia. She liked using poison darts, and we know that was the cause of death."
If Ben avoided personalizing the crime for just a few hours while he was working, he could hold it together.
"I'm not forgetting you, Mom. I just have to do this." "Alima's dead now, so we can't corroborate anything."
Chevu snorted in mock amusement.
"You have to learn not to mislay suspects, Ben. It's a bummer when it comes to squaring the custody records."
"She slugged it out with one of the Jedi sent after her. It was her or us, really. She kept trying to kill Aunt Leia."
"That explains why you look so much older these days."
Chevu made that "huh" noise again. Ben knew he disapproved of boys of Ben's age being sent into live-fire situations, but he didn't understand that it was different for Jedi.
"Okay, Jason is the prime suspect. A couple of days ago, he killed a lieutenant on the Anakin Solo, just like that, in full view of the bridge crew. He snapped Lieutenant Tebbutt's neck without even touching her, and threw Captain Neville across the deck. Shevu emerged from the kitchen with two steaming cups. See what I mean about fingerprints? Ben should have been shocked. He tried hard, but all he had was a sinking feeling that the only beings who couldn't see Jason for what he was were Jedi, and his family at that. Jason was leaving a trail of bodies. "He even tortured me," Ben said, realizing it sounded self-pitying as soon as it left his lips. At least he was still alive.
"Dad fought with him and stopped me killing him."
Shevu's face was instant cold control, as if he was reining in an outburst. "He should have let you. Jason Solo's a nutter. A psychopath."
"Jason's not mad. He's a Sith. You know what that is?"
"Frankly, no."
"It's a Jedi who only uses the dark side of the Force. Not a Jedi at all, really."
"A bad guy. But not illegal. Wrong cult."
"Yes, I suppose."
"Okay. Crazy, Sith, ethically alternative, whatever you want to call it, Jason demonstrates a tendency to extreme personal violence, and my cop's gut tends to take notice of that. What's your theory on your mother?" Ben could deal in basics with Shevu.
"Jason was in the right place. He had the means to do it, and I think his motive was that she found out he was a Sith. I don't have evidence linking him to the scene, except he found me with her body, and he shouldn't have been able to. The only thing I can pin down is location."
"Crime scene's compromised now, I suppose."
"I recorded it."
"Good man. We'll make a CSF detective of you yet."
"I've been telling everyone Jason did it, but with Alima firmly in the frame, they all think it's my grief talking. I suppose it's easier to think the perpetrator wasn't a member of the family. So I need your help, sir."
"Drop the sir. It's Lon." Shevu slurped his calf. "The vast majority of murders are carried out by people who are close to each other. Family, lovers, close friends. Emotions run high. They have easy access. One thing leads to another. You get the idea. The random homicidal maniac is still pretty rare, even in the lower levels of Galactic City. And yeah, I'll help you. This is a murder investigation." Ben never expected otherwise. He'd judged Shevu right, but he was also putting the man in danger.
"Can I ask what happened to Shula? Looks like you scrubbed the place clean of her."
"I sent her back to her parents on Vaklin, for her own safety. We got married in secret, and then I got her off Coruscant and got rid of everything here linking her to me."
"Why?"
"Because people who oppose Jason Solo end up a bit dead, and I'm building a file on him. The situation's going to get a lot worse. Once I got Shula to somewhere safe, my only dilemma was whether I wanted to see him impeached and charged by the Alliance, or whether it would be more satisfying to see Fett or the Jedi Council get him. I think Fett's revenge might be more fun." Shevu's dislike of Jason's methods had been obvious since the time Jason had killed Fett's daughter under interrogation. Ben hadn't realized it had developed into full-blown hatred.
"Let's do it together, then."
"Whatever it takes. And I'll stay on the inside as long as I possibly can." Shevu looked resigned. "And he likes to have me around, even on the Anakin Solo." Ben wondered when his father would notice he hadn't checked in and start asking where he was. He'd switched off the comlink, just in case Luke calmed him and the signal was spotted. He'd tell Dad soon. He felt better about that now. He had ways of expressing it.
Just tying up loose ends, Dad. Just making sure we didn't miss anything. It's okay. Lan Shevu's stopping me doing anything crazy. But at that moment, it made him realize that Dad would want Shevu to help, to be a spy in Jason's inner circle. And Shevu would agree to it because he couldn't get justice from the GA for the foreseeable future, and he was too decent and honest to turn to the Confederation. Everything Jason touched became corrupted. Ben took a deep breath, downed some caff, and concentrated on not letting his anger about that taint and all the people it was poisoning boil over. "Let's pool our resources." Shevu slammed his cup down on the low table and propped a blank holochart against the chair opposite. He took a stylus and began drawing columns on one side and the beginnings of a chart on the other. It was how the CSF detectives worked on a crime, Ben knew. "Let's write down everything we know. Discreetly, of course." Ben tried to imagine how utterly miserable it must have been for Shevu and Shula to marry and then have to part. He got the feeling that Shevu had been in a rush to marry her so that if anything happened to him, she would be taken care of as a service widow. It was depressing, but folks had to think that way these days. Jason really knew how to tear families apart. Admiral's private launch, en route for Nazoth. Neothel was never convinced that Jason wouldn't change the locks when she turned her back on him, but she refused to be tainted with the culture of paranoia that she could see developing in the civil service and among senators. Even so, she broke her journey to Nazoth and switched vessels 2, 3, 4 times on the pretext of inspections across a number of ships from auxiliaries to troop carriers, then left in her private launch alone without a pilot. There was healthy unparanoia, and then there was just asking for trouble. She could still manage to pilot a vessel without 10 officers to carry out her every command. It was the safest way. She rather hoped that the buzz around the fleet would suggest that old iceberg face was having secret assignations with a lover. It was always a handy story to float. And she had to see Luke Skywalker. It was the first time she'd been completely on her own, without crew on the other side of a thin bulkhead or security close to her quarters, for what seemed like years. It was probably a matter of months. She'd become wary of who she was seen talking to, who she calmed, and who she ate lunch with. Even Senator Gaselle, a man she had been relatively close to in political terms, just acknowledged her in the corridors and went on his way. The Security Council had no real function now beyond worrying what Jason was going to do to it, and he certainly didn't consult it. He seemed to need reminding that he had a duty to consult her. Well, she wasn't consulting him now. She took up position at the rendezvous point, 15,000 kilometers off Nazoth, checking her scanners for vessels and wondering if it was always going to be this way. The rebels had lived like this for 20 years, trying to overthrow the Empire. It seemed daunting. She was Joint Chief of State, and here she was fretting as if she were helpless.
"Stang," she said aloud, disgusted with herself. "It'll only be 20 years if you let it."
Luke Skywalker was late. She kept checking her scanner, increasing the range and looking for a wider spectrum of signals, and feared the worst right up to the moment the launch's proximity alarm sounded and she nearly ejected. The short-range comlink buzzed. "Admiral Neothel, permission to come aboard."
"Master Skywalker, you almost gave me a cardiac arrest."
"Stealth X. No point taking chances."
"I'll tell the manufacturer that they work just fine, shall I?"
The pragmatist in Neothel told her to make a note that stealth technology like that was great as long as the people you gave it to were always on your side.
The fleet had even found it hard to search for Mara Skywalker's downed StealthX. It was a two-edged sword. She waited until all the docking lights showed green, and then opened the aft hatch to the tiny cargo bay. The top canopy of the StealthX was wedged into a vacuum-tight docking skirt that made it look as if it had rammed the launch from the rear at a 90-degree angle, canopy first. Luke dropped out of the fighter's open cockpit and landed on his feet.
"I braked too hard," she said, trying to lighten the mood.
"Remind me to ask Incom to fit a docking tube." Luke grasped her hand as if he was grateful to see her. "Sorry, I just don't take chances these days."
"None of us do. Thank you for seeing me."
"This is mutual, Admiral. I'll have a favor to ask of you, too."
"I'll be brief, then. If you haven't already heard, Jason has taken to killing members of his ward room in full view of others, using force methods."
Luke shut his eyes for a moment. He looked older than Neathel recalled, with noticeable folds in his cheeks and a dull gray tone to his skin. She dared think something unthinkable about Jason, that he might have been behind Mara's death. No, that was an outrage too far, even for him, and waited for Luke to say something. He didn't.
"I know he's fairly cavalier about killing," she said, "but I suspect I was right in assuming this would mark some threshold for you, too."
"It does."
"Depending on how you look at it, then, it could lead to some advantage. And poor Lieutenant Tebbutt's life won't have been spent in vain. Jason may lose the loyalty of his troops, or it could simply consolidate a reign of fear."
Luke rubbed one hand across his face, brow to chin. "I think I recall how that morale-boosting technique played out in my father's generation."
"Well, I still have a duty to the Alliance and my personnel, and I'm still prepared to pass intelligence to you, provided you can use it to remove him. I don't care what you do with him. Restraint jacket therapy at some quiet monastic retreat, or shove him out the nearest airlock, but I want him gone."
That sounded harsh, but Neathel wasn't sure how far humans would go to bring wayward relatives into line.
"And out of office. Another coup is impossible at the moment, so the best I can achieve is to help neutralize his impact on the GA, and hope I don't lose the lives of too many good beings doing it."
She wouldn't have been the first officer faced with a terrible choice when her leader pursued a course of mutual destruction. Her loyalty was to the common good of the GA, not to Jason Solo.
"Hang on. I'm talking and thinking as if I'm his deputy, not his joint and equal colleague. What am I doing? Absolving myself of responsibility? I helped put him in power."
"I have Jedi working hard to seize him, Admiral," said Luke. "Do you think he's insane?"
"No."
Neathel had no hesitation.
"I've seen too many perfectly sane beings become utterly corrupted by power. Jason's not insane. He's just had his own way once too often, and now he can't see the world any other way."
"Do you know what I mean by a Sith?"
"I've heard the term, but I know nothing about them."
"They're Force users who prefer the dark side. Like Palpatine."
"Oh, I see. Fallen Jedi."
Luke pressed his lips into a little humorless smile and looked away for a moment. "Oddly, that's just what the Mandalorians call them. Their word means ex-Jedi, although that's not always the case."
"And does this make any difference to how we approach him? Does he have different powers from regular Jedi?
Luke looked strangely embarrassed. She wasn't sure why. Not really. He's just very strong, and he has an ability to use a battle meditation technique that gives him a remarkable awareness of the battlefield.
Ah, I noticed that. He has a young woman called Tahiri Vela running his errands now.
Which brings me to Ben. Luke moved closer to Neophil and looked into her face, which required some head-tilting on Luke's part because of the set of Amon Kal's eyes. He clasped her hand again as if he were searching for a pulse. Apologies, Admiral. We're all scared of our shadows these days. I might be putting a man's life at risk, so I have to be certain. Ben has gone off again, and I believe he's back on Coruscant. He thinks, I don't know, but he's probably trying to build a case against Jason for killing Mara. Neophil almost sighed with relief. So she wasn't the only one who thought Jason could kill his own relatives.
If I see him, I'll make sure he gets every assistance to stay out of harm's way, especially if he goes after Jason to take revenge.
He already tried that, after Jason tortured him.
Just when I thought the man couldn't get any worse.
Revenge isn't the Jedi way, and Ben's come to terms with that. But stubborn persistence is Ben's way, and he may come to your attention. He might be with Captain Shevu. They were close.
You trust Shevu?
Yes. There's such a thing as force certainty, and I have it in that young man. Neophil revised her view of the GAG captain. His attitude was courageous dissent, then. She'd have to persuade him out of that.
A GAG insider would be helpful to us all.
We become exploitative for all the right reasons, don't we?
We do.
Until next time, then. Luke swung back into the Stealth X cockpit in a gymnastic move that would have taxed a much younger man and braced his body using his knees while the seat restraints closed around him. Then the canopy closed. He gave her a thumbs-up gesture, as if he were just an ordinary pilot taking a fighter for a test flight, and the safety bulkhead closed to release the vacuum in the docking skirt. He was gone.
Poor Ben, Neophil thought.
She wished him luck, and decided she would make some for him if she got the chance.
No, Jason, you won't get away with this. Not in my navy.
Feta, Imperial Sector. Treasury Repositories, Darafa. The slab of carbonite lay on a trestle draped in synthetic gray velvet weave, looking for all the world like a funeral bier. Fett inhaled the musty air and held out his chip from the Registry of Testaments and Legacies, his authorization to collect the belongings of a dead scumbag called Rezodar. The lawyer's minion took it, checked it, and stood back to let Fett and Myrta cross the threshold of the storeroom. Fett didn't know Rezodar, and didn't care. He could guess the gangster's lifestyle. This was Feta, after all. On a bad day, it made Nar Shaddaa look classy. He hadn't been back here since the height of the Empire. Another element of his past come back to haunt him on this difficult day.
"I'll leave you to clear the store, sir," said the minion. 3 hours maximum. Everything must go. A droid is available if you need help loading.
There was only one thing Fett wanted. The rest, he'd jettison it, even give it to the deserving poor, or, given that this was Feta, the undeserving criminal classes.
"That'll be all," he said, and took a few steps forward.
The distance to the trestle felt almost as impossibly long
as the expanse of sand in the arena at Geonosis that he'd had to cross to retrieve his father's body. And then there had been Aelin's body, and reinterring his father's remains. Fett had played pallbearer far too often in the past year. He wasn't a squeamish man, but he was coming close to the limit of his tolerance.
"But Sintas is alive, and so are you, although you might as well be dead some days."
"What order do you want to do this in?" Myrta asked. She'd been quiet since he'd dropped his bombshell on her about Shisa. She stood on the opposite side of the shrouded carbonite slab and took off her helmet, the new one that Arade's father had made for her to match armor plates she had now painted a deep saffron. When she tidied her short curly hair with one hand, there was a brief moment when she looked a lot like her grandmother. It was the mouth. The eyes were definitely from his side of the family.
"Let's check the carbonite first," Fett said.
It wasn't what he meant, but it was easier than saying that he only cared about Sintas and everything else was ballast. He took the top edge of the velvet weave. The drape of the fabric clung to the little mountains and valleys of a face, a once familiar land. Then he drew back the sheet, and it felt like the moment he saw Aelin's battered face when Myrta opened the body bag. The shock of the face of a stranger he ought to have known, but whose life he had missed almost completely.
"Oh,"
said Myrta. It took a lot to shut the girl up, but it was the second time Fett had heard that choked-off gasp today. Even in the monochrome contours of the carbonite shell, Sintas was recognizable. Worse, she was beautiful. He bent his knees slightly to check her profile against the light, but she looked much as he'd remembered: high cheekbones, long, straight hair, a small, pointed chin. Her arms were at her sides. Her eyes were closed as if she were sleeping. He'd seen a few carbonited beings in his time, and they had been frozen in some paroxysm of pain or terror, because it wasn't a pleasant way to be put into suspended animation. But Sintas looked peaceful.
"Maybe the Barv froze her down dead."
It gave Fett a brief sense of respite, and he hated himself instantly for it. Dead Sintas wouldn't drag up the unhappy past or hang around demented and in torment. Dead Sintas was what he thought he already had.
"Face up to it, Fett. You were never scared of anything. What would Dad think of you? Too frightened to hear the truth again. You never could handle this stuff. It's how you ended up in this position. Maybe she'll be able to tell us how she ended up here," he said,
swallowing everything he wanted to say. It was 50 years too late.
"Get the repulsor lifts."
He clamped a unit on each edge of the slab and glanced around the room. There were just crates of varying sizes, sealed and dusty. He had no choice but to take them and go through them in detail later, in case they shed any light on Sintas's fate. Myrta checked the boxes and began attaching repulsors to them. She never needed to be told to make herself useful. She learned fast and got on with the job, uncomplaining, and did it thoroughly. It was only the emotional things, the issues about family and heritage, that seemed to provoke her into surly scolding. She walked the boxes out across the landing area and steered them up Slave One's cargo ramp with a practiced hand, then jogged back and moved the next crate. Fett stayed with Sintas's slab, unable to leave her alone in this miserable place.
"You ready?"
Myrta asked, peeling off her liner gloves and whacking them hard against her thigh plate to get the dust out. She put them back on and slipped her gauntlets over the top.
"I'd ask you if you were okay, but I'd never get an answer."
"I'm okay," Fett said. "Are you?"
"No. I'm scared. I don't know how to tell her about Mama. I don't know how I'll handle it if she ends up crazy and would have been better off dead anyway. But I'll deal with it."
"I'll tell her."
"Give me some warning. How did you two part the last time you met?"
"Fearfek. There's no way around this, is there?" "I shot her," Fett said. "And it was for her own good."
"Yeah. Somehow I didn't think it would be a moonlit walk along a shore on Naboo and a tearful promise to stay friends."
"It was to stop her opening a booby trap."
Fett flicked the controls on the repulsors and eased the carbonite slab off the trestle, aiming it at the exit doors. Myrta stepped to one side to avoid it.
"Just a small blaster burn. She would have been fine in a few hours. She always healed fast."
"You didn't wait to find out?"
"She wasn't dead when I left her."
"Well, she did better than Shisa, then."
He should never have mentioned Shisa. It was a mistake. He kept making them with Myrta. He made them with all women, in fact. Sintas didn't know how lucky she was that they split before he could really foul up her life.
"Shisa was a mercy killing."
Myrta turned her back on him, displaying a saffron plate decorated with gold sigils and glyphs that he'd seen on the Veivut clan's armor. She was definitely serious about Ges Orade then. That meant Fett would have a grandson-in-law soon, and with it a kinship to Novak Veivut and the rest of the clan. It was all getting too much for him, too involved, too rooted. Fett craved loneliness right then. Yes, loneliness. It was a much simpler emotion to handle.
"You sound as if you're straining out a confession a word at a time, Babuir," she said. "So either spit it out, or let's concentrate on worrying about Babuir."
Grandmother and grandfather were the same word in Mondoa. The language had no gender. Not that he spoke it beyond the odd word that Myrta had forced on him. It was the first time that something had grated on him. He was Babuir, nobody else. That reaction made him realize that he'd become a little too invested in the name.
"I didn't want to do it," he said. "I didn't even want to be Mandalore. But if I hadn't shot Shisa, he'd have died a rotten death. I owed him better than that."
"You could have done the decent thing and still handed over the Kyr Bez to someone else."
Fett had learned that word early in their relationship. The crown, the mythosaur skull reserved for the office of Mondalore.
"I gave Shisa my word that I'd honor his dying wish."
Myrta paused and glanced back over her shoulder at him, but didn't say anything else. He wondered if she believed him. He found he was completely unable to go on talking, and passed off his silence in settling the carbonite slab down on a bench in the cargo hold and draping it with the velvet weave cloth. It was one way of dealing with a painful memory, sticking a different one in its place. A change could be as good as a rest. On the journey back to Mandalore, Myrta kept getting out of the co-pilot seat and disappearing into the hold. When he went aft to see what she was doing, he found her sitting next to Sintas, one hand on her shoulder, talking quietly to her.
"She can't hear you," he said.
"Some say carbonited people do."
They said Han Solo did,
but Fett saw no reason to upset Myrta more than she was already.
"She'll hear you soon enough,"
Myrta carried on anyway.
"Maybe I'm rehearsing a difficult speech."
She was right, but she didn't know that it wouldn't be one-way traffic. Fett decided to face all that if and when it happened, and wished he'd been half the man his father had been. Jango Fett would have known what to say. Slave One touched down at Bevine's farm in Caldabe at dusk. A small, grim-faced welcoming committee met the ship, and Fett could only feel discomfort that he had an audience to observe yet again what a shabby job he'd made of being a husband and father. Dr. Belwine was there as commanded, incongruous in his soft city clothes, his white blonde hair whipped by the breeze. Bevin and his partner Medrit Vassar looked at the carbonite slab with matching frowns. It was rare to see Bevin wearing anything but a cheerful grin. Medrit raised an eyebrow.
"I'm no expert, of course, but that was a handsome woman you had there, Fett."
Fett noted the past tense and the implication of his ingratitude for the lucky hand he'd been dealt, and followed the slab into Medrit's workshop. The couple's grandchildren, Shalk and Breela, tagged along to watch the spectacle, eyes wide. Jintar, their father, moved in from nowhere and scooped both of them up in his arms. So he was back from the war then. His right hand was heavily bandaged. The next time he went to fight, Shalk would be old enough to join him and learn the craft of warfare. He'd be 8 next birthday, Bevin had said. It seemed far too young, and yet Fett had been at his father's side at that age and had loved every moment. Dangerous missions had been a rare treat. "Come on, Adika," Jintar said to them. "Nothing to see here. It's rude to stare at the Mandalore."
"Is the lady dead?"
Breela asked.
"Can we have her stuff?"
"Sleeping," said Jintar, and winked at Fett. Medrit had cleaned up one of the side rooms in the workshop for the carbonite removal process. It was where he recharged blaster power packs with Tibana gas. Belwine looked horrified as the slab was lowered into the release vat.
"It's okay,"
Medrit said, looming over the doctor. He was tall enough to make a Wookiee think twice.
"I've thawed plenty of this stuff. It's how we used to ship Nerf carcasses when I worked on Olenet."
"How very reassuring." Belwine opened his bag to take out a tray of pneumatic dispensers and vials of medication. "I must write a paper on that for the Galactic Journal of Endocrinology." Now the onlookers had thinned out to just Fett, Myrta, Belwine, Medrit, and Bevin. Medrit stood with his hand on the controls.
"Say the word, Mandalore."
It was said that carbonite freezing was how people had traveled interstellar distances before hyperdrive. Fett's most vivid experience of the technique had been Han Solo's incarceration, and the consequence of Solo's flailing around blind after being released from the block was still something Fett saw each day in the mirror when he shaved.
"Don't worry, Bobica,"
Bevin grinned nervously, daring to joke when everyone else looked on the grim edge of mourning.
"We don't have any Sarlacc here."
Only Bevin could get away with that. He was the closest Fett had to a friend.
"As soon as she's free of the carbonite, I need to get her heart rate and blood oxygen up right away to minimize tissue damage," said Belwine. He held a hypo spray as if it were a miniature blaster, and in his other hand he had an oxygen delivery device like an aquata breather. "Stand clear."
"Ready, Doc?"
Medrit asked.
"Ready."
Medrit pressed the switches, and the ferrocrete vat erupted with cold vapor and loud hisses as gas escaped. Fett thought it was noisier than he remembered, and then he realized it wasn't the escaping byproducts of the thaw, but the weak, panting squeals of a woman in agony. Belwine dived forward, blocking his path, and reached into the miniature storm that had formed above the vat.
"It's okay, Babuir. It's okay. It's okay."
Myrta leaned in too, taking the spent hypo from Belwine's hand while he applied the breather. Sintas wasn't screaming. She'd never been a weakling, not her. But the sounds she was making were incoherent, the panic of any terrified animal with something unfamiliar pressed to its mouth by a stranger.
"You're safe. It's okay. You're going to be all right."
When the vapor dissipated, Myrta held Sintas's hand while Belwine slapped a monitor on her arm. Sintas was thrashing about, trying to sit up, and staring totally uncoordinated, eyes rolling. She pulled her arm away from Belwine, grabbing blindly for anything. Myrta caught her arm.
"You're among friends," she said quietly. "Easy. Udesi. Just relax and let the doctor take a look at you."
Sintas looked right through Fett, her face all white terror made more stark by the ink-black Kifar tattoos, the Kukuf. She was blind. He was ready for that, but he wasn't ready to look into her eyes again. Dark blue. At once both everything he thought he'd ever wanted and the deserved judgment on what he hadn't given her. The last 50 years collapsed in on themselves, leaving Fett 19 again, besotted for a brief while, and then an older, numbed man, wondering why the only thing he could manage was to walk away to leave her in some filthy alley, knowing he was abandoning his daughter again, too.
"I didn't even ask about Aelin. I just gave Sintas the hologram and told her not to lose it again."
"Well, she can move," Belwine said. "No paralysis. Excellent."
"Shob, he's a sharp one,"
Medrit muttered.
"I'd never have diagnosed that in a million years."
Myrta and Bevin lifted Sintas and laid her on a repulsor trolley, wrapping her in blankets. She was calming down now, or at least exhausting herself into a quieter state. Fett dared to step closer. Bevin put a discreet hand on his back to steady him.
"Madam," Belwine said, "can you hear me?"
He checked the device on her arm.
"Can you tell me your name?"
She jerked her head in the direction of the doctor's voice.
"I heard..."
"That's good. Let's try again. Can you tell me your name?"
Sintas seemed totally distracted by the question. She settled on her back, eyes open and apparently staring at the workshop ceiling.
I don't know. Don't know. Who are you? Where's... Oh, Stang, I don't know who..."
Sintas had been frozen in her mid-30s. She was a shuddering wreck coming out of the agony of carbonite suspension, but she was still a beautiful woman.
"I owe her. She's not my wife now, but I owe her something for all those years I was never a husband or a father."
Fett had no way of articulating that aloud, because he'd never learned to go beyond that single, all-defining father-son relationship. But he wouldn't abandon her this time. At least he had some breathing space now to work out how to fill in her missing history. If she'd been in her 50s, 60s, 70s, he'd have done things differently.
He swore it. But she wasn't. She wasn't even old enough to be Myrta's mother. Myrta looked stricken, but her eyes were dry. She was a fat, all right.
"Let's get her to her room," Fett said. "Dr. Bellwine needs to carry out his examination."
"Amnesia's really common in carbonite cases,"
Bevine said kindly, following the repulsor into the main body of the house.
"But how much of the past would you want her to forget for good?"
"It's not her who needs to forget," Fett said. "It's me."